fans, Alton Brown here. You're listening to the Alton Brown Cast, and it is going to be an especially good one today. I'm going to be interviewing a lady today that most of you do not know. Her name is Katie Allen, and she is a culinary producer at Food Network, and she and I have worked together on the following shows. We have worked together on Food Network Star. We have worked together on Next Iron Chef, Iron Chef America, and she also runs the culinary operations for Cutthroat Kitchen, which you may have heard of. She is smart. She is capable. She is full of stories, and she's nice. And she's one of my favorite people to work with at Food Network. And so we're going to spend some time finding out from her what it's really like to be a culinary producer on all of these crazy shows. So we're going to be visiting with Katie Allen. The whole show shouldn't take more than about an hour. So stick around because, I mean, really, what are you going to do with the next hour anyway that would be better than listening to this? Exactly. All right, Alton Brown, the Alton Brown Cast, recording from my palatial penthouse suite at the Maritime Hotel in New York. And I'm talking to somebody that doesn't even know why she's here, even though what she does is incredibly interesting, and she's done a bunch of shows with me, or I've done a bunch of shows with her, is Katie Allen from Food Network. Now, Katie.
Hi.
You are a culinary producer.
I am.
Now, people that are fans of food shows don't see you. They don't know
in general
who
that's
you are
true.
And what you do.
Correct.
But you've worked on most of the shows, with the exception of Good Eats, which you never got to work on or never forced to work on. The shows that we have done together include Iron Chef America, mm-hmm. Next Iron Chef, mm-hmm. Food Network Star, mm-hmm. Cutthroat Kitchen, and what else have we done together? Thanksgiving Live.
I was there. That's true.
But you also are running the culinary world of other shows, including?
Of recent Hook, Line, and Dinner for Cooking Channel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you keep me busy.
But you did the last Robert Irvine, everybody get on an RV and
I was a part of Restaurant Express for
Restaurant
a
Express,
little while, yes. But I was not the lead okay. on that show, nor did I last the entirety of it.
Did you get kicked off the RV?
Yeah.
Did you say
something? There was it turned out there wasn't so much need for two culinary producers, and there was one there for the entire run.
Got it.
So we were good. I got to come home. I was with you in LA for
yes.
Cutthroat for a very long time.
You needed to come home.
I needed to come home. That's the moral of the story.
When people meet you, And you say, hi, I'm Katie, and they say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a culinary producer at Food mm-hmm. Network, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they say, oh,
what's that?
And your answer is typically the following.
It is a range of things. It is on one end, I am a glorified dishwasher. And on the other end, I like to say that I connect the dots between production companies who know all sorts of things about cameras and editing and story and making deals with talent, and a kitchen that needs to provide food and equipment and support for that said talent that is starring in a show. So I coordinate between production and kitchen. I make sure
you make the food show up.
I make the food show up. I make the equipment show up. I make sure there's a kitchen on a beach that some chefs can cook on.
Well, let's talk about that. Now, when you say chefs on a beach, we're talking about Next Iron Chef.
Yes.
So a production company, and in this case it's Triage, who we work with a great deal, says, okay, we're going to do this big scene on the beach.
Yeah.
And if you're a fan of Next Iron Chef, you've seen this at least a couple of times.
Yep.
So you've got, at that point, that's usually beginning of the series. So you've got maybe nine-ish
mm-hmm.
people.
Yep.
So we've got to have grills. We've got to have cooking stations. Mm-hmm. We've got to have coolers with main ingredients. Mm-hmm. And we need an entire pantry.
That's correct.
Set up on a beach.
Yes.
And then they say go.
Water and bus tubs and everything from coal to matches to quart containers and spatulas and everything that you would need in a kitchen.
Every piece of hardware and every piece of software.
Yes.
All the food and everything that touches it.
Nothing's going to plug in. So we start thinking about, okay, we don't have so much electricity on a beach. We're not going to bring food processors and stand mixers and blenders. What else are we going to bring so these people can do what they need to do in the time frame that they need to do it in?
And then you've got to actually make all the lists, get all the people. You have to
load up
that
a truck.
Happen.
Yes. Yes. And then we schlep it all out 100 yards on a beach and build it.
And nobody says thank you.
Sometimes someone somewhere says thank you. Usually it's triage. You say thank you often.
Well, it's because I've done enough of that job. It's like it's a catering nightmare everywhere you go. I mean, it's because it is kind of like a catering job.
Yeah.
Only for temperamental chefs who are under a lot of stress.
Right.
Who are probably going to yell at you for something.
Correct.
All the time.
Most of the time,
Most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I cannot imagine, I mean, if you're a fan of Next Iron Chef, every challenge was in an odd place. You've got to go into a diner kitchen, or you've got to go into...
I mean, three different hotel kitchens in Vegas and a baseball stadium and a lake. And where else do we do it?
Well,
farmers market.
At least at a lake, you know you've got to bring everything.
Yeah.
And
then we throw it all in the lake so we don't have to schlep it back to the truck.
Somewhere out in the middle. I don't even remember the name of that lake.
Lake Irvine.
Lake Irvine. Not named after Robert Irvine.
No.
But yeah, did you guys like bring some cement blocks and just sink some stuff out there?
There are cinder blocks.
You sunk stuff out there. But in a situation like that, at least, you know there's nothing.
Correct.
Whereas if you're going into three different hotel kitchens in Vegas.
Yeah, makes our life a lot easier.
Does it really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The restaurant's easier because...
Absolutely. I mean,
Almost think starting with nothing is easier because then you don't assume anything.
No. If you're starting with nothing, that list is 7 pages long. You've got a team of 7 people packing trunks, wrapping speed racks full of sheet trays full of hand tools, loading up cube trucks, and hoping to God that you haven't forgotten anything because you're out an hour and a half from your stage where everything is and you're on a lake with nothing. But if you're in a hotel kitchen, you call the executive chef, you say,
hey, do you guys have?
What do you got? What can you bring? Do you have guys that can like source everything for us? I mean, it's actually... Working in those kinds of situations are great because we will go in, we'll scout the kitchen, we'll meet with the chef, we'll assess what's there and figure out, okay, they have one Roboku and we've got 4 chefs cooking in here, so let's bring our electrics.
Roboku is a really nice, big, fancy, strong food processor, just so you know.
So we bring our own electrics to make sure that the chefs have what they need. But it's a lot shorter list and a lot less stuff to
carry. So it is better to build on a foundation of something that already exists.
Absolutely.
Now, on a show like Cutthroat Kitchen, there's a soundstage. And on one side of the soundstage, there's a set. And the set is where we shoot and what everybody sees. And then, literally 20 steps from there, is another world that's about the same size and shape, which is Katie World.
Well,
the Culinary World, which is another set-aside zone that literally stores... Everything, every ingredient,
everything,
every tool,
yep.
Dishwashing stations,
yeah,
because the dishwashing never stops.
Never stops. It goes on. I mean, three rounds of cooking. That's turning over the kitchen.
That's turning over the kitchen. You got some pretty massive refrigeration units,
yep,
to hold all the proteins and all the dairy and all of the perishable produce. Mm-hmm. What am I forgetting? Because I go in there and there's just racks, and then you've usually got four to six people depending.
Yeah.
And on a day-to-day basis, let's say on a show like Cutthroat Kitchen, what does your to-do list look like on a day-to-day basis? Not when you're setting up, but when we're actually in the run of a show like Cutthroat Kitchen. What
happens when we walk in the door?
Yeah. What is your to-do list? I mean, like, I've got a to-do list. I know what I got to get done to be ready for the day. What are you doing?
We walk in and I sit with my team. And I write down on a piece of paper, usually because creative changes frequently.
Daily.
Challenges change. Food changes. So I sit down and I write down a list of all the different specific proteins or food items that need to go out for...
Protein means meat. Usually.
Usually. That goes out for a round of cooking. So, I mean, my team knows, stock the pantry full of produce. Stock the pantry full of butter, sugar, flour, dairy, things like that. But if there's, you know, if it's a specific hamburger, make your best hamburger round of cooking, I'll tell them, all right, 2 pounds of ground beef is going out, 2 pounds of ground turkey is going out, 2 pounds of ground chicken is going out, and so on and so forth. So we write this list so that everyone knows what to take out to set when. Mm-hmm. Then a couple people go out to set and double check that cooking stations are identical. We've got 4 cooking stations, so they need to look exactly alike.
All the same hand tools are there.
All the same hand tools.
Same spatulas.
Exactly.
Turkey basters or whatever.
Microplanes and zesters and peelers and things like that. So we double check the set. We make sure everything is working, that the power hasn't gone out, and we've lost a whole fridge worth of something.
Because that's happened.
That has happened.
That happened on season 1 of Cutthroat.
It did, before we even started
shooting.
Wasn't
it like on a Friday or something?
It was a Sunday.
So it's like you didn't even know it? Oh, yeah.
It was a Sunday, and I got a call. I was at my little sister's high school graduation, and I got a call that said, I think a fridge is open. And I said, what do you mean a fridge is open? And, well, we heard some beeping back in the culinary area, and a door was ajar. I said, tell me what the temperature says on the top of the fridge.
It's a red readout, top right. What does it say?
And they said, 58 degrees. And I said, awesome. Stay where you are. I'll be there in 36 minutes. And
so you left your little sister's graduation?
It was coming to an end. Yep.
Okay, so it was wrapped up.
It was wrapped up, and I got in the car, and I drove to Burbank and assessed the situation, and there was some stinky cheese and some stinky meat and some warm cream and milk. It was probably $3,000 worth of food that just expired.
And it was literally because the door got left open?
That's correct.
So maybe in the future we need to have like locks or something on those gosh darn things to kind of like ensure that they are indeed closed.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of – there are signs on these fridges now that say, make sure I'm closed and don't leave me open and things like that. So, yes, I then proceeded to the nearest Whole Foods and spent a lot of money.
Yeah, they like seeing you come. Ma'am,
do.
Can we help you
they
with your
do.
Cards?
Yes, yeah. Oh, you have 5 cards? Come this way.
Yeah.
So
you get the valet service, concierge level.
Yeah, so we restocked it. So those are the kinds of things that we do in the morning. We make sure that the set is ready for the first round of cooking, and my team sort of organizes carts to quickly turn over the kitchen. So they organize a cart full of pots and pans to restock after the round is over. We put more food on carts to restock the pantry. And then I go into a room with contestants and we read the rules of the game. They ask a lot of questions.
So you're pretty involved in that kind of legal side of the challenges as
I
well.
I have been for Cutthroat. Yeah, I have been very involved. I think because I've been very involved in the creative process.
Now, how did that happen? How did you evolve into that role? Is that simply because you are the culinary producer?
I got lucky, I think. I happened to – so when we started Cutthroat, the idea was born somewhere between Food Network and a production company and
right. – and Embassy Row and
– And you got excited about it, so they pushed forward. And we all decided – well, not me. Somebody decided we should do a gameplay. We should come to Food Network kitchens and we should see if this actually works. Let's find some interns, some culinary students, play around of it and see what it looks like.
Yep, the home edition.
The home edition.
We played the home edition.
Exactly. So they needed a culinary producer.
And that happens
producer.
A lot, by the way. You do a concept of proof.
You
got to run it. You got to see if there's
shot. It's got legs.
Yep.
So Embassy Row came to Food Network and the network executive said, we need a culinary producer. And my boss said, who's available? And I had just gotten back from Food Network Star. Wasn't put on another show yet. And so she assigned me to the project and I helped do this kitchen run through.
I remember.
And
was that the one I was here for? Because
yes.
Then you guys did another one that
yes.
I wasn't here for. Right?
I don't think I was
I thought
there
was
for
another,
either. There was something in LA
they
that they
one.
Did at the culinary
oh,
school.
LA.
Yeah.
Well, no, that was the Not For Your Pilot.
No, there was another one. Yeah, there was something right. that neither of us were a part
okay.
of. I think they were just testing like specific sabotages and things to see how it played out.
All right. Anyway, so we did the
Anyways,
one here.
So we did the one here. And I have a big mouth. I opened my mouth a lot and I told them things weren't going to work and things were going to work and you should think about it this way. And I think that I had a great rapport with the 2 executive producers and they realized that there was value to having someone with culinary knowledge.
on a culinary show, one would think.
Yeah.
And but that's not always the case.
It isn't always
the case. I'm shocked by production companies that'll be like, oh, we need some groceries.
I know. There's a lot of shows that culinary producers will do where they just say, make sure we've got food, make sure we've got equipment. We'll see you there. And that's fine. That's just one way to use us. So
if there's no real concept in that, then I mean, but something like Cutthroat actually requires somebody who can think through, because we're messing with people.
Steps.
And you got to think through, okay,
a lot of cooking steps.
What comes out of that dumbwaiter?
Yeah. And for this kind of a show where we are messing with people, we have to be able to say to these contestants, there's a way to succeed. And that's where I come in during rules and in the morning with these contestants. We go through all the rules of the game. We go through all the psychology of the game. And then they look at me and they look at the other producers and they say, you're basically telling us that this isn't possible. And it's up to me to say, no, I've got a culinary background. I've been in the room the whole time. And if I haven't thought of a way out, it won't come out of the dumbwaiter.
I remember looking at you with the little hobo stove for the pancakes. Remember, made out of a tin can. With votive candles.
Yep.
I looked to you immediately because I was like, I don't believe you.
And I showed you a video on my iPhone.
Yeah, you did.
Of one of my team.
Yes.
Who set up the tin can with the votive candles and, to boot, made a spatula out of tinfoil because that was another sabotage. So in case the one person ended up with the tin can,
and the tin foil
and the aluminum foil instead of tools, that it was possible. And I have it on my phone and I showed it to you and you
shut me up. I did not.
You rolled your eyes a little bit and you turned around and walked away.
I rolled my eyes. You've been yelling at me for years on. I mean, because how long have we been doing Iron Chef together? Do you know when we started doing that?
I've been working on Iron Chef for 5 years, but I've been in your ear for 2 seasons.
2 seasons. So for those of you out there that don't realize it, during any given Iron Chef America battle, just to change channels momentarily, I see 8 cameras at a time. Mm-hmm. You want a napkin for that? We're trying to negotiate very full glasses with lots of citrus.
I'm going to sip.
Yeah, me too. I see 8 cameras,
mm-hmm.
which is not really that much to follow story. So there has always been.
I see 10.
There's always been a culinary producer up mm-hmm. in the control room mm-hmm. who can not only see more cameras,
yeah.
but is getting constant reports from culinary people on the floor.
That's true.
And then if that person being Katie, or for a while it was your boss, Jill, and
yep.
then she quit doing that, is constantly then feeding me information about yep. what is going on. Or if I start a sentence that I can't complete, you basically finish it for me,
and
then I'm basically just mimicking you.
It's true.
So half of the time on Iron Chef America, it's actually Katie speaking through me. I am
merely
a puppet.
Or Jill, yeah.
But
it's we just have fun. I think that I think I approach it a little differently, where I am a little less concerned about getting perfect answers for you.
No, just an answer.
And so I just start filling in blanks and talking, and
you also
it is
know
what
I won't challenge you either. You could say all kinds of horrible things, and they would
know,
come out of
I
my mouth.
I don't know why that is.
You've never taken advantage.
I don't
of
know.
That.
I don't know why that is.
Why I do it?
Well, no. Why you don't? I mean, I think that
because
you
I'm
could,
usually doing something else. I don't
you
think
could
about
challenge
it.
Me.
No, because once you start, if I start a sentence and you start completing it, and then your words start coming out of my mouth,
mm-hmm.
I've already moved on to something else.
Yeah.
I'm doing something else.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm either
That's
reading
fair.
Something, I'm researching, or I'm looking at another camera. Because
yeah.
my only marketable skill is being able to say things without actually using my brain.
It's pretty incredible.
It's my only skill.
Well, and it scared the bejesus out of me when I realized that, A, this was a whole process that happened. I mean, I started on Iron Chef America as an intern 5 years ago. I was an intern at Food Network.
I didn't realize that.
I was an intern.
That was only 5 years ago?
And it was the first show that I was a part of as an intern.
Right.
And
what part of that shocked you?
That
or
you
just the whole thing?
Well, I mean, Iron Chef America in its entirety was just the most amazing thing that I could have been a part of as an intern in her second week.
That would put the bang
I mean,
on somebody's
stop.
Head, wouldn't it?
Are you kidding me?
There's a lot of groceries.
There's a lot of groceries. There's a lot of spatulas. I mean, it's walking, and I still get that feeling. I don't know if you get that feeling. Every year, walking into Kitchen Stadium for the first time when it's built, because we have this big studio.
It's impressive.
And one day, Kitchen Stadium isn't there, and the next day, it's there. And there is something so magical about that set and the show. And so the fact that I was an intern was super cool. And then I was seeing people actually, these chefs actually cook in 60 minutes. And I was like, okay, I've been around the block and this is actually real. And then I went upstairs to this control room, which is like a space station. I mean, it's NASA.
It's very NASA-like. A lot of blinking lights.
There's blinking lights and there's headphones and there's microphones and there's
monitors
people
everywhere.
And monitors and just bodies sitting in front of these monitors and and everyone's doing something different and everyone's talking over each other. And I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
That's pretty cool.
And then I sat next to my boss, Jill, and had no idea what she actually was going to do. I mean, the battle's about to start and I'm sitting next to Jill and you start talking and then Jill starts talking and you're saying what she's saying. And I was just blown away.
You thought I actually knew everything that was going on
in the room,
didn't you?
You didn't realize.
Look, this is television, sister.
I did.
I'm not a schlump, but there's no way to know.
It was just so fascinating. And then, I mean, over the years, I was a back kitchen assistant, and then I was a floor reporter. And so I was one of those people that you just mentioned on the ground feeding information to Jill. And then one day Jill said, I don't want to do this anymore. Somebody else has to do it. Danielle was already doing it. She wanted somebody else. You're going to do it. And I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep for like two nights before I actually, like my first battle. And I was so tense during that first time that I did it. I was so tense. I was sore the next day. I was so nervous.
Do you remember what the ingredient was that day? What the secret ingredient was?
I don't.
I was trying to remember.
And I believe it was I think it was a Bobby Flay battle, because I just remember thinking to myself, I'm going to see blenders and there's going to be herbs and oil in them. And I'm just going to make up the herbs because I won't have known which herb he put into his herb oil. And the 60 minutes ended. You didn't yell at me.
Now, that suggests that I've yelled at other people. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have.
Yeah. So you didn't yell at me.
I didn't yell at you.
And I remember walking down the stairs. I walked out of the control room, down the stairs to the set. And I didn't know if I should go up to, I mean, we had a rapport, but we weren't buddies yet.
No, we weren't buddies yet.
And I remember thinking, should I go up to the podium? Should I say something? Should I just like pretend this never happened and and move on? How should I handle this? It's amazing how vivid this is, because it was such a poignant moment in my career. And I did it. I went up to you and I was wearing a scarf.
Yep.
Because it's cold in Kitchen Stadium.
Freaking cold most of the time. And the control room's even colder.
It is. And the first thing you said to me was, it's okay, you couldn't do it. It's okay. It's no big deal. And I said, What are you talking about? He said, well, you know, I figured you just put down the headset and Jill got on and Jill did the whole thing. I said, no, it was me. And he said, really? And I said, yes. And you tugged on my scarf and you said, you're all right. I mean, it was really...
No, you did. You did it. You nailed it from day one.
I was just so bowled over. And I thought, okay.
Job security. Sweet.
Okay. Like, this is...
You do it every day.
That's pretty awesome. And it was kind of a career-affirming, life-affirming moment that maybe I hadn't made a mistake.
I have never affirmed anybody's life, so I'm glad I could be involved in that.
You know? But you had to have had a moment at some point. I mean, I'm young. I've only been in this particular food network world for, you know, 5 years now. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about was two years ago. I had recently gone from freelance producing stuff to full-time. I was an employee. And it was a moment where I was like, okay, maybe I'm supposed to be doing this for a living. You had to have had one of those moments where someone said something to you and you thought, okay, I like what I do for a living and maybe I'm good at it.
I'm thinking. Hold on.
Oh, come on.
Most of my affirmations have been negative. You need to find something else to do, kid.
Stop.
Okay. You mean a time when something happens, somebody says something that makes you think, yeah, I'm okay at this.
Yeah.
I had one that happened in Kitchen Stadium. Mm-hmm. That was before that. It was a day that right before a battle, somebody came up behind me. And I think I've told you this story before. Somebody came up behind me at my station when I was prepping. And I heard this voice say, "You're funny." And I turned around and it was Bill Murray, who had come to be
story.
A guest because I can't remember which Las Vegas chef it is. It was a big friend of his and golf buddy had come.
Oh.
Long-haired guy. I can't remember his name. It was a burger battle, I think, against Bobby Flay. Anyway, he was
oh,
a friend.
Yeah.
Bill Murray
okay.
was a friend of his. So Bill Murray came to the show. And Bill Murray came up and said that I was funny. And I thought, this is one of those incredibly important times where the next words out of my mouth are extremely, extremely important.
Right,
and so I just looked at him and I said, "What would you know about funny?" Which made him laugh. And then he went and bought me a hamburger. So that was a good day. That was
so
life-affirming.
That went well.
Very, very life-affirming.
Yeah, right?
So those things happen. But a day that, battles in Kitchen Stadium are either energizing and fun.
Yep.
Or they just suck the life out of you. And
yep.
they drag and it's like, oh my God, this hour will never, ever,
never
ever,
end. Longest
ever.
Hour of life. Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it's almost always about what's going on up in the booth. Because mm-hmm. if I can get everything going properly with the booth, then it's mm-hmm. just like this lovely dance and the dance is over and everybody's happy.
Right.
And
yeah.
Sometimes
and
it happens.
Also, I think it has a lot to do with the energy of the chefs.
Hmm.
I mean, there's an energy that either happens or doesn't. I mean, there's a chemistry thing that happens. I mean, we've had battles go extremely smoothly, and I think that we've done fine, and we've covered pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it was painfully long, and it felt weird and
creepy.
And yep. we felt like we were watching the same thing happen again and again. It was still that bowl full of that same mixture that we saw 30 minutes ago. Like,
and then that's the curry powder, the egg whites,
right.
and the blah, blah, blah,
right.
and blah, blah,
that
blah.
That was transferred yeah. to a piping bag. It's still in the piping bag.
And it's still there.
It's still there.
Right.
And there's just nothing left, you know? So I think it's...
Was there ever a time you were intimidated just by the ingredients themselves?
Oh, sure.
Because I remember first doing this. And Morimoto would show up, and I would wake up at 4 in the morning because it's like, all right, last night I studied 12 different kinds of kelp, and
right.
now
well,
I'm doing this.
Do you remember the seaweed battle?
Hitting my head against the microphone.
The seaweed battle was brutal, and I wasn't calling at that point. I was a floor reporter. And so I had the sinking suspicion that Jill would be saying to me, which seaweed is that? And I would be
the
saying—
The green one.
I don't know. It's just seaweed.
It's just a bunch of
it's
green
just
stuff.
Green leaves. I don't know.
Horror.
Yeah. And then we get the ones with all the chemicals and the
powders.
White powders. Powder it's just,
75.
I don't know. You'll say, which one is that? And I'll say, who cares? Like, I don't know. You know, let's guess.
Let's just say it's methylcellulose.
Right.
Until
it's meat glue.
It's
meat glue. It's always meat glue.
Yes, it's sodium alginate, blah, blah, blah. Carrageenan. That's another one you can always just pull out. That's
my favorite is when you freak out over microgreens and flowers and you get so hung up. You're like, which one is that? Which one is?
Because
I don't know, nasturtium. Let's just say nasturtium every time.
See, I noticed, but that one I know. When it comes to remembering flower and leaf stuff, I can look at, okay, I know micro bull's blood.
Right.
But I'll look at micro arugula.
It
and
could
it,
be
at some point,
cilantro.
That all
it
looks
could,
the same.
Yes,
it's like,
it does.
Oh no, that's micro chervil, and I should know that.
Right.
I'm like, well,
why?
I know shiso mm-hmm. and wakame or whatever wakame. I know the important one. And the other thing that I'm really, really, really bad about is I freeze up on mushrooms. I can look at a mushroom, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, I can't remember if that's a maitake
mm-hmm.
or a matsu, whatever it is.
Right.
And so I keep this big database open on my computer.
Oh, do
with
you?
Pictures. Oh yeah, because I will just. Forget.
But I know, and then you get stuck a little bit.
I really don't want to let it go.
And there have been moments where I've said to you, "Move on."
I know, because I don't want to be the dumb guy. I'm so afraid of being the dumb
but
guy.
But you're not. That's what's but, you and you. Yeah.
But when you look and
you're
like,
nuts.
Is that a matsutake? I can't. Sometimes though, I'm faking it Sometimes I'll, I learned that
because I at one that. Point you mumbled under your breath, I'm just doing this. Stop because telling me the right answer.
I want it to seem like I'm having to go find an answer because it's dramatic. And one of your predecessors, she would scream at me and be like, yeah, I'm trying to remember what that. And she'd be like, it's blah, 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 blah. And I'm like,
I know.
It's okay. It's a TV show. I'm just trying a little drama thing here. And she would get so frustrated at me. She would be screaming, Sriracha, Sriracha. I'm like,
yep.
Yeah, stop screaming. Got it. Thanks. Yeah. You're scaring the people in the booth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's...
Because sometimes you do. Something is boring or sometimes I just don't want to look like I'm reading a script or that I actually have a list of all those ingredients, which we sometimes do and sometimes we don't
I think part of my secret, which is now no longer a secret because I'm going to tell all the people that you're...
You're going to tell all 12 of the people listening
that are listening
to us,
right? Especially with me. I'm not. No. Anyways.
No, you'd be surprised.
I talk to sous chefs beforehand. I try and get a sense of like what is going to happen. What are they going to reach for? What are what's going to be done first? Just to get a sense, like if they're, I see pressure cookers, I want to have a sense of what protein is going to go into that pressure cooker just so I can start anticipating for you because my whole job revolves around if I can just see something before you see it. That's what's screwy about the process is I never know what's going to come out of your mouth. And so I have to know before you start talking about it. I have to see it before you see it.
So, but there are some things that we know. If we see pressure cookers, we know that, number one, they're going to be used within the first 15 minutes
of
the bowl. Because then you know, so you look at a kitchen, and I'm sure you've learned how to do this, is that given which quarter of the battle we're in, we know what's going to happen when as we see certain tools.
Things are going to go into the oven. Things are going to come out of the oven. Things are going to go into the fryer. They're going to come out of the fryer.
Pasta dough is going to be made in the first 10 minutes
absolutely.
Of the battle, or else somebody is really screwed up. We know when we see things start to go into plastic bags. It's either a piping bag or it's going into an immersion circulator. It's going to be just cryovac. And so there are these patterns that emerge over and over again.
Exactly.
So when you do this enough, you do learn that it's just the pattern repeating itself.
Right.
And, you know, the beginning of a Bobby Flay battle, there are going to be blenders.
Yep. And there's going to be oils coming
together.
There's going
to be an herb oil. There's going to be a chili oil. Although not as much this season.
I was calling battles in the afternoon, so I didn't – Bobby always cooks in the morning.
It wasn't as often this time.
Changing it up.
So now that you're not a rookie anymore, you're not that – wide-eyed intern of 5 years ago.
That's true.
What part of this gets you up in the morning besides a paycheck? What do you like about what you do? Because I have to tell you, the organizational skills alone make my head spin. That you can do.
I'm a sucker for a list. That's one basic, but that's not what gets me up in the morning.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
I love organizing anything, condensing anything, throwing anything out. That's who I am.
Is that part of what makes the job fun for
you?
Oh,
yeah.
You feel a catharsis in the organization part of it?
When you load into a set and you've got 200 boxes full of cooking equipment, and you know in 3 days all those boxes are going to be gone and they're going to be metro racks with lined up pots and lined up pans and lined up stand mixers and they're all shiny and new and organized like that.
You're a general lining up your artillery and your panzer divisions and your...
That's really good for me. But no, I think I'm a TV girl. I've always been a TV girl. Since I was little, I've watched television probably more than I've done anything else, embarrassingly enough.
But you realize how rare that is in this day and age for people to say I'm a TV person.
I've just always loved it. And I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles, and so not only did I watch TV.
And you were around the business because your dad.
I was around it.
He's a big-time major league agent guy.
Well, he's a lawyer.
Same. Yes, he's a lawyer, but he's an entertainment lawyer plugged into big
stuff. But he wasn't always. When we were little, he was a real estate lawyer. And so I wasn't necessarily in it, but I went to a small elementary school where a lot of kids' parents were in it. And so field trips would be – I mean, when I was in first grade, Brandon Tartikoff, who ran NBC, his child was in my class. And so we got to go on a tour of the NBC studios. And I saw cameras, and I saw studio audiences, and I saw actors walking around a set. And
that hooked you?
There was just something team sport-like about it that I really was into. I loved the idea that there were 60 people in a room making something that all these people were then going to watch and be entertained by. And it's stuck. And so after college, I went and worked at a talent agency, and I didn't know what it was going to mean.
What was your degree?
Psychology. Okay. I went and worked at a talent agency, and I was an assistant to an agent, and that's what you did. You were an assistant to somebody just to sort of get your feet wet and learn the nuts and bolts. And so I learned nuts and bolts, and I learned a lot about what I didn't want to do. And so after 3 years of being in the agency world and thinking, I might be good at this and people seem to like me, but I just want to throw my BlackBerry in the garbage. I don't want to be on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that's what agents do. And so I quit, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was sitting around watching Food Network. I was sitting on my couch. I was 23. I mean, I figured I can sit around for a couple months. Like, I'm not 30. I don't own something. I'm not married. I'm going to sit around.
I don't own anything, and I'm not married. So I'm going to sit right here and watch TV.
Yeah, and I watch TV because that's what always make me happy. And I watched a lot of Food Network. And I thought to myself, someone must work there. There must be somebody doing something there that I'll find interesting. Because I've always loved food, too. I mean, food has been a part of food. What? I mean,
who
what person?
Like food?
Exactly. So my sister had actually gone to culinary school. She, my older sister, worked at Food and Wine magazine in the test kitchen. Okay. And she seemed happy. So I thought, what if I could put those two things together? And I went to culinary school with the hopes of maybe working at Food Network someday. And so I did it.
Did you tell people that at school?
No.
See, I made the mistake when I went to culinary school of telling people why I was there. I'm going to make a food show that's like this and this and this. And
right.
Like,
and they were like,
mine.
Exactly.
You are not going to do any such
Correct.
Thing.
Right.
Moron.
Okay. You and win
nice.
The lottery. Yeah. Good luck to you.
Yeah. Yes. Now shut up and cook the potatoes.
No, I didn't really. I mean, I made it. People would say, what do you want to do after school? And I would say, I don't know if I want to work in a restaurant. I don't think that's the right path
fun.
For me.
Yeah,
I'm not physically fit for it. I don't have that. I don't know what it is, but
that macho drive thing.
Yeah. It's just not in my DNA. So I never really said TV, but I never said I'm going to open my own restaurant. And, we had to do an internship to mm-hmm. wrap up school. And so I, through a convoluted channel of connections, somebody got my resume in Food Network, and they said, you can be an intern if you fly here and test in the kitchen trail. And I thought that went horribly, actually, come to
really?
Think of it.
Why? What happened? What happened to make you feel that?
Well, I had taken the red. I was in Los Angeles in culinary school,
so
and
I took
the red eye. I landed at 6 a.m. or whatever, had to be in Food Network kitchens in my school uniform at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. or something. And I am tired because who sleeps on red eyes? And I get there and I'm trying not to freak out because I'm so nervous. I feel like I've put all of the last year's eggs worth of eggs into this basket, you know? And so I sit down with Miriam, who is the sous chef of the kitchen. Miriam, lovely lady.
We all love Miriam.
We all love Miriam. But at the time, she was very just dismissive, and she had a lot
terse.
Going on.
She was terse.
There was all these people working in the kitchen. She had other stuff to do. She didn't want to.
Like, we got real going on here.
Exactly. Yeah. And you just go cut up this
onion,
and here's an emerald recipe. Make it. You know, I want to see all your mise en place. Yeah, right. Exactly. So I did it, and I was nervous, and they don't really show you around the kitchen. The kitchen is, you know, 60 cabinets full of different things. Where's the bowl? I don't know. So I'm opening every single cabinet looking for a bowl. No one's saying hello. No one's helping me. And I'm just like, don't cry. Don't cry.
Don't cry. Don't cry. Don't cry. You're tired.
I am an adult. Don't cry. So 4 hours later, I'm done doing all the list of things she's asked me to do. And she comes over and she says, didn't anyone ever teach you how to cut a bell pepper in culinary school?
Ow.
And I knew enough.
Like that?
Yep.
Should have liked that?
Oh, yeah. And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I thought so, but please show me, chef."
Did you put chef on the end of it? Like
I did.
Did you ever, were you actually curious though as how she was going to show you?
I mean, yes, I was, because I didn't know what she was talking about. And it turns out I hadn't taken the membrane off. I hadn't taken the membrane off.
Did they teach you that at culinary school?
No.
Interesting.
So she showed me and I said, "Wow, thank you. I learned something. Thank you." And she said, "Okay, clean up." And it was like within 25 minutes, I was cleaned up out on the street and on the phone with my dad back in LA saying, "I think I just wasted $400 on a plane ticket," because no one said another word to me. It was bizarre.
What happened next, though?
24 hours later, I got a call from the person who was in charge of the interns.
Right.
And she said, "We'd like to have you as an intern. We really think you need to work on your knife skills." I said, "Thank you. Okay." And I got off the phone and, you know.
Were you back in LA by then?
No, I was still in New York. And I flew back to LA and I had, I think, 4 more weeks of school and a boyfriend who turned into my husband many years later, but a boyfriend that I said, I've got a 3-month internship at Food Network. This is all I wanted, and I'm going. And I'll be back.
New York.
I'll be back. 3 months. No harm, no foul. Like, no big deal. And he said, "Okay." And I left, and 3 weeks later, he had a job in New York, and we've been here for 5 years.
Yeah. I wouldn't let you play that 3-month thing either. No, I wouldn't let that go. Yeah, about 3 weeks been about it. Did you go back to anybody at school and say, "Gee, my knife skills almost kept me from getting this job. Thanks a lot. How about you teach me better?"
I went back and I told the story and everyone laughed. But to be honest with you, I don't have the best knife skills. I don't. I mean, I'm not an artist. I've never been good with, I mean, it's just not,
no.
I'm a really good thinker. I'm a really
good organizer.
And I'm a great cook, but I don't think I'm anything better than a great home cook. And I know my stuff, but there's endless more to learn. And I would never think of myself as like a chef or a chefy in training or anything like that.
I went to a school where you were required to take 2 internships. First year internship and a second year internship, and I took the hardest French internship that I could find, not in France, because I couldn't take my wife and my dog with me to France, so we moved to Vermont, but with a guy who is notorious, is, you know, like breaking the dreams of culinary students. And but I went because I thought my knife skills were, I thought I was pretty good.
I got
I thought that I was a real, you know, Yoda with my lightsaber. And I'll never forget being given, it was Brunoise this, you know, sure. And it was, I don't remember what kind of
tournée
it was. It was chilies. It was, my tournée was okay, but I do all this big pile of Brunoise, and this chef who wore these wooden clogs, we called him Ahab because you would hear him coming up behind you, clop, 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 came up to my board where there was, a mountain of Brunoise, you know, laid out on my board. And he reached in and dug down into the levels, and he came up with the piece that was, this wasn't an eighth by an eighth by an eighth. This was like an eighth by an eighth by a quarter. And he was like, "What's this?" And he wiped the entire board off into the trash and said, "Do it again."
No.
And that's when I was like, okay, I'm not actually a hotshot, but
I
got to where I would practice my knife cuts in the dark. And then finally with my eyes closed, I had to be able to do every cut with my eyes closed.
Wow.
Without cutting myself or getting a cut wrong. Everything had to be by feel. So I worked on it and I worked on it, and worked on it until I became like a super freak. My skills aren't where they used to be, but I used to be a food processor, man. Because I never wanted to face that again. The feeling in my stomach.
No,
the only thing that got in the way of crying was that I was going to throw up. I was going to vomit and cry at the same time. But anyway, now people cry when they see you. You scare people now.
That's not true.
You don't think you're intimidating.
I don't think so at all.
But you're intimidating in an inspiring way. You're a good general. People will follow you.
I like to think so.
The contestants on Cutthroat Kitchen have been a little scared of you.
But I'm so warm and so reassuring. Really?
It's so nice that you think that. I've seen them kind of like cower from you, and you'll say stuff, and they kind of look back and forth at each other. Like, here's the kitchen, you know, captain.
Yeah, but person. I'm looking out for them.
Well, yeah, but you've got some stern stuff
I do.
Going on.
I don't have the highest patience level, but...
Well, I didn't say you weren't merciful, but...
Part of my job is making sure that talent, whether they're contestants or Alton Brown or whoever it is, yeah. it's my job to make them feel comfortable in the cooking space that they're in.
Now, right now, you're getting ready to leave here to go back into a little room with executive producers.
Yeah.
One executive producer of Cutthroat Kitchen.
Yeah. And our challenge producer.
With challenges.
Yes.
Has this been... Of course, those of you that have, no doubt, the millions of you that have become
addicted to Cutthroat Kitchen.
I have to say, have you been on the third floor of Food Network?
Yeah, it's weird.
It's spooky.
Yeah, that room. I was there. I was in a meeting in that conference room yesterday, and it was like, okay, we get it. Stop yelling at us.
Every piece of art in the place is from Cutthroat Kitchen.
I can't breathe.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no way for us to succeed.
I don't need to be in a room where there are eight other versions of me looking at me.
I
got to go. Anyway, so obviously the show's a mega hit.
Mega.
We're secure for many, many years.
Right.
But did you think that it was going – when you first started helping to design the challenges, these auction items that we do, that it was going to be – did you think it was going to be easy?
No.
Because I kind of did. I kind of thought, oh, look, you give them a hot air popcorn popper and tell them they have to toast all their spices in that. Or you do this, which, by the way, would be a good one. I thought it would be easy. But it turns out it's not actually easy at all.
It's not.
Because they're all game pieces. And because this, for the first time on Food Network, it's not a competition as much as it's a game. And
correct.
Games are complicated.
Correct. There are a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
I mean, God bless Chopped, because Chopped – could go on forever. There are infinite combinations of random food items.
And your basket is a pixie stick.
And it's
a mushroom, a clod of
dirt. Well,
and
it's awesome to watch because it is pure cooking.
Yep.
And it's a super cool show to watch.
Yep.
This is a constant chess game that we have to play before we even
Because you have
start
to know
shooting.
That it's playable.
Right. So we have a grid and we're constantly moving pieces around it, and you know someone will say, "Okay, it's a spaghetti and meatballs challenge. Let's take away their ground meat." Okay.
Then.
Fine. What's the next item up for auction? Exclusivity to pasta. Okay, so one person's going to get pasta. That means three people are now cooking without pasta. One person is now cooking without meat. Okay. The third item up for – and it just goes on and on and on where we're constantly looking at every possible combination to make sure that it's still possible. If one person ends up with all the sabotages, does he have a fighting chance? Because he should. It shouldn't be
– it shouldn't be the death knell.
Right.
But you've got to be good. You've got to cook your way out of it.
And we had one guy who had no pasta and no meat, and he made the only plate of spaghetti and meatballs that looked –
Like spaghetti and meatballs.
And that's...
You're right.
I didn't know if the show was going to work until that moment.
Was that really it?
Yep.
I knew the show would work when we shot the Not For Air pilot
In
L.A. Now, that wasn't your culinary school.
No.
No. You'd gone in L.A., but not to that one.
Yes.
When we were done with that day, I was like, this is a show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be harder... Mm-hmm. than we think, because you've got to work out every possible move.
Every
it's
scenario.
It's not like playing chess. It's like playing out every possible chess move in
correct.
Any given series of combinations.
Yep.
What we really need is a computer program.
We do.
That can just generate challenges that we then can just evaluate and say, no, that's
nope, not going to use.
So it would say, if, you know, 2-inch tongs, then this, then this, then this, then this. And then you've also got to take into account the human nature part.
Oh,
of
everything.
The auctions.
And that was what was so unbelievable about season one is, I mean, I really thought, okay, it's a jambalaya, it's a gumbo round or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go for the Holy Trinity. They're going to go for an onion,
a green bell pepper, and celery.
And that is a fact.
Gotta be.
And
yet.
And 3 out of 4 chefs walked out of there missing one of those things.
I was flabbergasted.
Dumbfounded.
So. Because you've set up everything based on that.
Right. So, I mean, there really is. I mean, I think there should be a show about us trying to predict what happens on Cutthroat Kitchen just as much as there should be a show called Cutthroat Kitchen. I mean, what we go through, that control room is – I mean, the Iron Chef control room is awesome, but the Cutthroat Kitchen control room is a constant roller coaster of emotion.
It's a closet. It's not a control room. It's set up in a closet. Let's be really honest about that. My biggest thing on the thing that drives me insane on Cutthroat Kitchen is I'm right there, and I so want to say, look – Blah, blah, blah. Look over there. You're just like, look. I'm pointing. I'm surprised. Look at that. You can do this. And you're like sitting there going, no, I'm not going to do that.
I'm surprised you can't hear me from 100 yards away in the control room screaming, why aren't you touching the tortilla press? I mean, that tortilla press could have solved a lot of people's problems.
And yet, if I go over and touch it, the lawyers jump out of the ceiling at me because they're affecting the game. There's an actual lawyer there all the time. Cutthroat Kitchen.
Yeah.
Do you think after chefs and cooks and caterers and anybody else that might be a prospective contestant sees the show and knows what the show is about, that it will fundamentally change the way it gets played?
I think a little bit. I think that people will start to anticipate the general directions of types of sabotages that we throw at them. So we've got a pattern now where if there's a fruit component to a dish, we might take away your fruit and give you the candy version of that fruit.
Or the canned or the frozen.
So I think that people will start to anticipate a little bit what we're doing, and we're inevitably going to have to change directions. I mean, we're going to have to keep making a right turn when they think we're making a left turn. And there's a lot of psychology, and I think that we will be affected.
So it's going to get harder.
It's going to get harder for us. So this will be a group effort for sure if this continues.
Oh, don't say if.
As it continues.
Thank you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I hope that people have some sense of appreciation now of the stuff that goes on that they don't see and
it's
don't know
cool.
about. That every show where you see a piece of food or a chef touches a piece of food, there's an army of people organizing that, planning on it, getting there, stocking it, and as you said, washing the dishes.
And they're all pretty cool people.
By and large, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the people that I most like to hang around with on any given show are going to be the culinary crew.
We have fun.
Camera guys and culinary, pretty much it for me. Stay away from the producers. They scare me.
Scary.
That's it.
Thanks.
Hit play. Food fans, that's about all that we have for you. That's everything. That's the show for this week. I want to thank you for listening. I also want to thank Katie Allen, delightful young woman who is the culinary producer at Food Network that I've worked with on so many shows. If you enjoy shows like Cutthroat Kitchen, she's one of the reasons why. So thanks, Katie, for spending time with us. And until next time, hey, cook smart.